Hi, folks. I hope you're having a fantastic day. And I've got a very, very good and very informative podcast guest today. His name is Ptolemy Pruden, and he is the author of China Rising, The Case for Containment. And in this book, it explores what actions the United States and its allies can take to address the rapid militarization of the South China Seas by the People's Liberation Army Navy. That's Plan, P-L-A-N, and other military services. I know topics like this can be really polarizing for people, so I urge you to listen to the podcast in its entirety, then make your judgment at that point. Also, please listen to the second part of this podcast, which could be found on episode number 199, and in that episode, we dive into the economics. So again, please listen to the podcast in its entirety. I'd also like to say thank you for all of you who continue to support this channel. And for the new folks, please remember to like, share, and comment. And please remember, if you are a pet owner, please have your pets spayed or neutered. All right, let's get into the show.
You know, this is, once again, this is really of high interest, I think, not only just to me, but to everybody, the nation. And if it is not, it needs to be. And again, you are the author of China Rising, The Case for Containment. And, you know, once again, it's broken down into three parts: the history and policy, technology and war, and the economics of war. But what I'd like to do first is find out from you your experience in armed forces and defense. And I think you specifically lean in towards the Navy, if I'm not correct.
You are exactly correct. I think doing an overall scope of where I am. So for the last 30 years, I've been studying foreign affairs and weapon systems, and more precisely, the lethality of the Navy. So if you look at our armed forces in the United States, there's a Space Force or Air Force, the Army, Navy, the Marines, and then you also have Coast Guard. And that population of that those servicemen and women, it's about 3.3, 3.5 million people. Our nation has 333 million people in it. So about 1% of our population is responsible in defending and executing the defense of our nation. On top of that, you have the civilian leadership, the president, you know, the joint, well, not the joint chiefs, but the president and the Congress. And all of those persons are in charge of developing policy for our nation. So that leaves 330 million Americans, us, the everyday civilians, who are outside of the beltway, who need to understand how our national security and national defense is implemented and executed on a day-to-day basis for nearly $1 trillion that we spend every year on the National Defense Authorization Act to defend our nation. So that's the group where I'm representing, the everyday American. Now, we have a podcast called the Common Sense Defense Podcast. And the Common Sense Defense Podcast specialty is training or talking to the everyday American about options and actions that they can take to make sure that our nation stays strong. We can support the military, support defense planners, defense policymakers, and also the defense industry. So that's kind of what Common Sense Defense does. And then I wrote the book, China Rising, the Case for Containment. That book is to the policymakers, explaining the detail about how they can change their policies, procedures, appropriations for national defense that puts us in a secure position more so than an insecure position, i.e. or like the Navy decommissioning ships every year. So we only have 290 ships. So every year you're taking away 10 ships. And so by 2027, we're projected to have 290 ships. And China's projected to have 440 ships. So that delta, we have to make up. And we really can't. Mm. So that's kind of what I'm focusing right now on, helping the Navy. That's the first group I like to help.
Okay. Now, I'll probably be jumping around a lot on this topic of policy and technologies on war and what we have. And I say that because, you know, I am the 300 plus million or the 299 plus million who is not aware, you know, other than saying that, you know, we might say, well, we're not going to go to war with China. We're not going to go to war with anybody. Yeah, it might be 10 years from now, 15, 20, but the threat is immediate, right? I mean, it really is.
It is absolutely immediate. So let's look at Ukraine 3 years ago. They were thinking that they were secure, even though they had everything contained in the eastern part of Ukraine with the Russian-backed forces and the eastern forces that were breaking off from Ukraine. They thought they were secure and safe. Where are they today? They were in the midst of conflict. You look at 3 or 4 years ago, the people in Hong Kong, they were free, being able to share their thoughts and protest. But all those college-age students, all the people that were there then, they're now under the oppressive hands of mainland China. You look at the Uyghurs, which for the last 10 years have been put in jail and prison by the Chinese because of their ethnic and religious belief sets. So you're looking at all those dynamics. If you look at Taiwan, which is just like you and me, they voted for their government, but now they're in a situation every day they have hundreds of planes from the PRC that are flying with, near the airspace, threatening them. So you look at just how 3 years, things can change, things can switch. And so that's kind of how I look at national defense, is making sure that we're proactive and providing a space for everyday America to live their life and grow into their future.
Yeah. I want to throw one thing out there. You said PRC, and I just want people to know that's People Republic of China, correct? Yeah. Okay. So you're a family guy. I mean, you have a relatively large family. So this, I mean, I say that because I think people who may be single or not a family person may not really think of this as much of an important topic. But again, we're talking about U.S. American defense. It's the entire country. So not just an individual is at risk. We all are. So as far as like the Navy goes, you know, taxpayers put a lot of money into it. And some of the things that I've read is, you know, the Navy has a lot of redundancy in it. And there needs to be maybe a shuffling of spending. Is that, am I not right okay. about that? Or
that's good. Okay, I love this. Okay, so yes, I like your assessment. So the Navy spends about $370 billion a year, and so there's what's called the NAVC budget that deals with the surface combatants, making sure they're maintained and all. That's the biggest portion of the Navy budget. But it's how you manage the money. So it's not like there's redundancy. There are a lot of platforms. There are aircraft carriers or cruisers, there's destroyers or submarines, there are support vehicles. But it's not about so much the number and the redundancy. Of course, in the Navy, in any weapons system, you have to have redundancy. But it's the maintenance. The maintenance has really gotten us. And so the maintenance has been where we have cut back our ability to support the ships that we have developed and deployed. So consequently, when a ship has to go for its availability, which is its maintenance cycle, it doesn't have a place to berth. It doesn't have a place to get fixed. And so it sits there and waits its turn in line. So because you don't have enough maintenance availability, you get a backlog. So some ships have been sitting there waiting for their turn for 2 years, 3 years. And you have to reconcile that delta. So that's the first thing, is getting more resources into our maintenance budget so that we can support, maintain more ships than we currently are. First thing. The second thing is not decommissioning ships. If you don't decommission ships and invest in the platforms that you have, then you are able to project more lethality out into the fleet and out towards our adversary via deterrent. So that's where we are now. Now, there is a technological component where 10 years ago, you needed to have all of your ships and their missiles connected so they can work. It's not like that anymore. You can have a barge and put a container on there with surface-to-air missiles, surface-to-surface missiles. And you can launch those containerized missiles from anywhere in the world. And so that's where we are now. So when they tell you, oh, we can't update this platform because it's too old, that's not accurate. So it's a, so that's kind of where I talk in the book. What options can we take to make the platforms that we have more lethal? And to that end, I'm talking about adding more containerized systems and or just adding containerized systems to those platforms so that you can add more lethality. And so that's kind of where we are. And then the second thing is, they would say, oh, you need to update the Aegis Block 9 system to go to the next iteration, when it, all you have to do is make it possible to launch those missiles on board the ship from off board. And so you don't need to update the Aegis system for $600 million when you can just connect an interface there and launch the missile virtually or from off board. So those are the types of things I'm looking at.
Okay. This makes me think of several different things. One of which is, like you're saying, that the we are decommissioning the ships maybe sooner than need be. One, and you know, two is, like I said, these platforms that we can have, they could be just simply barges, which could be like man-made islands, man-made, you know, platform surfaces out there, and those would be relatively inexpensive, I'm gonna guess, as far as budgetary needs go. My thinking is, I know, is the decommissioning and is the relative slow pace as far as things being maintained, could that be due to the drop in recruitment? Because that's been dropping for a number of years for whatever reason. Is that a possibility?
That probably would be a goal of the Department of Navy, is to utilize more autonomy and more technology to compensate for the drop in recruitment. And I think that that's going to be a trend that we see going forward for the next 10, 20 years.
Okay.
Until we deploy fully autonomous unmanned surface vehicles, unmanned underwater vehicles to go across the Indo-Pacific or across the globe. So that is a trend that's going to happen. And so what's going to happen is you won't need many people to man those platforms. And so that term is called optionally manned, where you have a platform that can have a human being on board or not have a human being on board, it will still function. But the thing is, the Navy is trying to push the technology forward that may not be totally capable of operating right now. And so that's the danger. I personally am not a person pushing policy for armed unmanned vehicles anywhere near China, anywhere in the Western Indo-Pacific. Unmanned, yes. ISR, which is intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance platforms, unmanned drones, all those fun things, yes, that can be the case, but not anything that's armed. So I think when the Navy positions itself as we're going to develop all these unmanned platforms that you cited and put them in the front, I'm totally against that.
Okay.
I think only as a part of a system of systems, but not being the end all be all. So you have to look at technology where it is now, and then where it's going, but you can't let it usurp your wisdom on that, the fact that you need human beings to prevent war. You get war when people think they can get away with something. You look at Putin. He thought he could get away with invading Ukraine and get in and out. It didn't work.
Yeah.
You look at Xi Jinping and how he has managed the economy with China. He has a crisis in his country that he generated himself. through making sure they had more policies that were anti-Western and more pro-CCP, and consequently he controlled his economy to the level where they are now. So there's another conversation we can have another time, but those are the things you're looking at. Policies and practices that are perpetrated by dictators, and they're screaming, oh, I got this problem, when they started themselves. Okay. So when you look at developing a Navy or a military that is using unmanned vehicles, unmanned platforms, you have to look at the whole totality of things and say, okay, I've got to understand where technology is, and what it can do and what it can't do.
Yeah. So we're really not talking about, when we're talking about our armed forces, as far as adding human bodies, that's not really what we're looking at. We're looking at being able to utilize our current technologies, future technologies, and being able to defend ourselves better. Because I think with China, and I'm not sure what age, but every citizen or every male citizen is basically, for a couple of years, they're required to enlist, be in the armed forces.
Yeah.
And we're not. And at any given time, I mean, if they outman us. But as far as technology goes, we are still ahead of China in technologies in warfare, are we not?
That's a good one, Chuck. So the answer is we are indeed still ahead. However, caveat, the amount of money that they are spending on their R&D. Now understand, China does not do R&D how we do R&D. We do R&D by the Defense Department. The material goes to Defense Department. The Defense Department, through maybe DARPA or some governmental program, gives money to universities. They become, and their data becomes part, by agreement, part of our system. In China, everything goes to a central pot for technology. So whenever you see like an unmanned rocket that lands, like SpaceX's rocket, of course they copied, that belongs to the government. That data, the technology belongs to the government. Even though it comes under the name, quote unquote, private company, it's not. Everything belongs to the government. So any technological capabilities, whether it's a 1 nanometer computer development capability, which they don't have, I don't believe they're working on it, that belongs to the government. So everything. So when you say R&D from China, everything public, everything private, everything, the people belong to the government in China. In the United States, we the people of the United States, you know, they, all their people belong to the Chinese Communist Party, all of them. So the technology and infrastructure, data, all of that belongs to China. And so they have to be a big vacuum cleaner and pull all the information out to make sure that it goes to their defense capabilities. And guess what, Chuck? They layer, when they produce ships, they layer civilian ships with military ships to cut the cost down. So, you know, it's a whole concept that you have to understand that we are dealing with, that we don't even operate like that. But yeah. What we do have, we have democracy. So even though we make a big mistake, you give us 2 years or 4 years, we can modify our mistake and put somebody else in. That's not the case in China. They're stuck with their leadership until he decides not to lead anymore.
Wow. I can see the upsides and downsides on both sides. I see us as having far more benefit as far as citizens go, but, you know, as far as how the funding works and everything like that, man, we have many protocols and how we have to follow things, especially for our defenses. And of course, you know, out of the 300 million people, we have maybe, a fair amount that don't want to put the funds towards the armed forces. And I can see where that in itself is a problem here too. And I don't know if that's because they don't understand that there is an immediate threat or if it's something else.
It's a combination. I mean, I think most people, because they don't follow foreign affairs or foreign policy or defense policy, there's a degree of ignorance or not being aware. And so they don't understand that when you see an airplane flying a jet, that there's a cost of maybe $10,000 to $15,000 that's going along with an airplane. So when that plane lands, you see it flying for an hour, there's a cost there. And that goes into the sustainment cost. So most Americans don't see. Here's an example. When you see one of those missiles that we send off to Ukraine, and the missiles fly through the air, okay, it's going on, it's going to blow up a Russian tank or something. When I see that missile flying, I think of what was cheap is going to be expensive to replace. So you're looking at maybe a five-fold increase over the price. So M39 missiles are better cost now than it was 8 to 12 years ago before they had it and then where they got out. Storage. It's not funny. I mean, but so most people don't really see that it costs money to run the military. So when we had to deploy over in the Middle East and in Afghanistan, it costs like almost $800,000 to $1 million per year for that one troop to be deployed for a year. So their cost when you use the military. So people don't understand that. Then the second part is people want their kids educated. They want buildings built. They want roads that work. They want electrical systems that work. All these things come through public works or some iteration thereof. And so they said, well, let's spend the money on our civilian capabilities more so than the military. We're not at war. And so they don't, so that's the dynamic. So you have to, I look at both parts and see both parts, but most people don't look at both parts. Now get this, to be able to live your life and go to the baseball game, go to the basketball game, to be able to go to church, you go to church or go to a knitting group, to have the freedom to do that, you have to pay for it.
Yeah.
And the defense allows you to have the freedom to do what you want to do, to go where you want to go, to say what you want to say. Yeah. And that is a cost. And there's a fiscal cost, there's a personal cost, there's a political cost, meaning voting for whoever you're going to vote for. We all have a part to play to maintain our democracy.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
What you just said there, really, the last couple paragraphs, I'll say sentences, is exactly it, and that people don't understand. And I'll just put it right out. There is a price to freedom. You know, there is an underlying cost. So, and I know that a lot of people scream and cry about if the Navy makes a new jet, and I'm not even going to try to call one out, but you know, $110 million for a cost for a single jet. And they're saying, why? That's the cost of safety and our freedom. And it's not just for the U.S. It's helping our allies as well, is what I believe in, because our allies are very important in all of these instances for peacekeeping.
You're okay. So that was a very big statement, Dave. When the people have a major part to play in that, they have to keep that system going. But they do and should push for fiscal responsibility and clear policy that comes from the Defense Department, from Congress, and from the president. So sometimes they waste money. And that's what the everyday American citizen says, look, don't waste money. I'll give you more money if you don't waste money. And so that's kind of how I look at it is, let's use an example again, the Navy. They waste like $100 billion over the last 15 years. They had a failed DDGX, the Zumwalt class cruiser, the stealth cruiser, stealth destroyer, $30 billion. The Ford class aircraft carrier, $5 to $10 billion. The LCF, the Littoral Combat Ship, $30 billion. Take it, throw it off the door. I saw a ship 2 years ago that was brand new, and it is now decommissioned.
Wow.
Because they couldn't manage their program correctly. So for me, that's what the American citizen wants, is a program that has a clear policy of development, rolling out, an execution of mission. That's what the American citizen wants. They want good fiscal responsibility and good common sense understanding on how to roll out these programs. And so the LCS is a clear example. I'm not in favor of drafting the LCA because there is a problem with it. It couldn't engage its engines correctly above a certain speed. I think it was 35 knots, 30 knots. For me, I'm like, load the thing up with containerized missiles, send it to the front, make sure you keep it under 25 knots, perfect platform for 20 years, that kind of thing. So you don't need to decommission that. Yes, I understand there's a gearing problem, but operate within the parameters of the gearing problem. Submarines do it all the time. How can a submarine have it certified to dive a certain depth, let's say 500 meters or 1,500 feet? It has to be certified when it's been around for 10, 15 years. Every time it goes like this, this submarine is certified for X amount of depth. So you can do the same type of certification for the gearing circumstances for the LCS. And so that's how I look at it.
You know, that's the thing. Why is it that we do keep the submarines, the subs, around for quite some time? And we don't do that with the other technologies and stuff that we have in the Navy. I don't understand that. Is it because it's a can that goes underwater with human lives and, you know, people are going to scream if we don't take care of that part? Could that part be part of it?
That's good. Yes. I mean, you don't want to have loss of life for 115 people, 115, 20 sailors. You don't want to have a loss of a nuclear reactor on the bottom of the ocean that's flowing for 30 years. Then on top of that, you don't want to put your Navy in a situation where it's not secure as it travels around the world carrying a nuclear reactor.
Yeah.
But to your point, you could do the exact same level of stringent capabilities for surface platform. And I think the Navy, they want the next shiny thing. They want to move to the next platform. There's a couple of reasons. One, they want to have cutting edge technology for their fleet. They have to keep their suppliers up and going. So there's a lot of reasons that I want to go into all of the reasons, but they want to go into a lot of reasons why they want to keep the next iteration going. I'm not a proponent of that. I'm a proponent of doing the most that we can with what we have. Take, for example, not the Arleigh Burke, but the cruise, the Ticonderoga class cruiser. The Navy for years has been trying to kick them all to the curb and get rid of them because they say they leak, they're old, da 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 da. So we have to say, and Congress has to keep the Ticonderoga class platform until you have something to replace it. And so those platforms we need to keep and switch up to what I say is a containerized system of weapons launch capability, and also making the platform over where it's able to get off-board technology and off-board information on how to launch its missiles, so you don't need to use a Spy 1 radar anymore. You can fire from off-board data without using your radar. I do want to come back and talk about your international component that you brought up about our friends now. I do want to mention something about that later.
That would be great. You know, this whole thing should be something that people know. People meaning everyone. Starting in high school, at least, I think that we should know current history, not current gossip, but current history, and more so, I think foreign economics need to be thrown in there. You know, I'd like to kind of go back around the topic of the technologies and the unmanned vessels and things like that. Mm-hmm. But you also mentioned that we do need people to prevent wars from happening. So how are we drawing that fine line between too few people or too many people that control these buttons and things?
That's a very good question. That's good, Chuck. So the first thing is deterrence. Deterrence needs to be so lethal that anyone wants to say, if I go to war with this country, I'm going to lose everything. And so you've got to get everyone thinking that if I push this line or cross this line, some very unfortunate, unpleasant things are going to happen to me and my forces. The second thing is, there is an autonomy component to those high-tech vehicles you're just discussing. So you can have a computer managing the flight and execution of a mission for the drone, or cruise missile, hypersonic missile, all those different platforms have an AI-based brain that you're rolling out, that it will now be able to execute the mission accurately and doesn't need human intervention. And so there's a term called man in the loop. That means I see a threat, I push a button, and I let this platform go do its job. The platform sends me back information, say I'm getting ready to intercept or destroy this target. I give it a thumbs up, they destroy the target. But there's an AI component that says there are 1,000 targets. Do I have clearance to send these 200 weapons to hit all these targets? And the human in the loop will say, yes, we're at war. They're firing at us. And it's all looking good. Go. And the AI will send all those platforms to destroy all those weapons. I mean, destroy all the targets. And so that component is where we are now and where we're going in the future. There's a missile, and it's called the Naval Strike Weapon. And that missile will go and hit exactly on the ship where you want it to hit. There's another system called the LRASM. It has a longer range. It has a range of about 250 miles. It will hit exactly on the ship where you want it to hit. And it also can coordinate with 3 or 4 or 5 other LRASMs and hit a ship at the exact same spot on different peripheral spots, all down a smokestack, all in the anywhere. It's different than the old days where you fire a torpedo and hit the side of the thing. Totally different now. That being said, if you can stealthily deploy weapons that can sink a ship and hit any spot on the ship, that changes the paradigm on how warfare is now fought. You see those videos of the tank in the Ukraine, the Ukrainian standard missile, and just blows up the tank. Those tanks cost at least $1 million. And the weapon costs $100,000 or $50,000. So the economic component is totally shifted on in. And so that technology and capability is what's coming towards naval combat. So that's where we are, is that you have to look at the cost of how much it's thinking. Is to sink a ship.
Yeah.
Not a lot of cost. And that's where you want to take that up as high as you can. In my book, I talk about how we need to have a 3-to-1 ratio, meaning each platform should be able to have 3 different ways that it can destroy a PL. And meaning it's hit it with a drone, you hit it with submarines, you hit it with short long range or something. Mm. So that if they take out 1 or 2, you have a 3rd that can do the same thing. And so those are the type, that's where we're headed. So once we start fighting, for me, I'm getting every human out of there that I can. I'm bringing in all the autonomous drones, all the robotic systems, and they're going to have a free-for-all. And then we'll go back in and do a man-to-man teaming to do what needs to be done. But that's kind of how the future is. And guess what, Chuck? The next war that we have, if it's a major level war, it won't be a war that lasts 3 or 4 weeks. It'll be a war that lasts 3 or 4 days. And a non-nuclear war, 3 or 4 days, it'll be over.
Wow. The way you just said everything, Ptolemy, is frightening. It really is. But a necessity. Now I do understand why you need to show might, because, you know, if everybody eventually or sooner than later, if not now, has that capability to be so precise with their missiles, it is now who has more, who's bigger and who's stronger, and a deterrent. Like I said, we need to be strong enough to deter people from to making any strike against us Americans. The other component of that is where you're saying with the AI, that makes me also understand now, like you said,
We need to have that human intervention where the AI can target all those, and then it comes back and it asks a human, you know, is this what you want me to do?
Yes.
And
yes.
It's a yes.
I like that.
Yeah, because I think a lot of times right now people have that fear, you know, there's that movie out there, Creator, now, and it's all the AI. We're afraid that the AI is going to take over the world, and it's going to run everything, and it's going to blow everything up, which I suppose it could go that route unless there is some sort of human intervention. So,
I mean, you're right, though. I mean, I think that's where things are headed. I mean, and I think that's where Elon Musk, president, who doesn't matter if you're independent, Democrat, or Republican, the bottom line is everyone needs to be knowledgeable about the capabilities of AI as it relates to the civil society.
Yeah.
Because, you know, and that's not just our AI. There's the European AI, there's the Chinese AI, there's the friends and allies AI, and then there's the terrorist AI. And so you're able to, what is that term? You're able to inject a virus into an AI and turn the system against you. So that you have to be prepared for that. That there's someone somewhere working on an aggressor AI that will turn what you have against it, against you.
I wasn't going to say this, but this is something I've been thinking about for the past, honestly, 30 years, and it may sound far-fetched, but I believe that eventually the world governments are going to realize that the cost of war is so high because of all the infrastructure that it destroys that we're going to have a new way of having war. And it's going to be like Stratego, and it's just going to be a flash of light. And that flash of light is if you're within that kill zone, you are pre-warned before this is going to happen. But if that flash of light goes off and you're within that kill zone, you know, again, this is taking it really far. People are always afraid about government overstepping and putting in chips in our bodies or, you know, following us. And I'll, 80 years, 100 years from now, I honestly see that happening. It's that light goes off, boom. Well, the government knows, well, you were within that kill zone and you need to go to the incinerator. Well, science fiction.
Case. I think we saw that maybe 30 years ago. That you're exactly right. But that capability is here now. I mean, just, yeah. I think, who is it? Israelis some years ago gave this guy a gift of a cell phone and had a bomb in it. He took the bomb, took a cell phone, and eliminated him. And they had this term called the Gorgon Stare. It was used in Afghanistan. It was on a drone, and it could just stare. And anything that moved, it would be to tell you what's different. And so when you put that with facial recognition does your nose and your cheekbones, and everyone like your ID or your thumbprint, your face looks different, even under a mask. And so those technologies are there now. You're just talking about a fusion of those. And the question is, what is an end effector?
Mm-hmm.
Is the end effector a missile? Is the end effector a laser? Is the end effector a bomb or some type? Or is the end effector electromagnetic pulse? So, no, that's easy now. Especially, yeah, so it's not easy. It's not a complex thing. And that's why having this government that respects people in life is important. And that's why it's important to have a government whose policies are looking at all of the different types of technologies and anti-technologies that are out there to be aware of those, defend your. So you're looking at defending in their space domain, defending in the cyberspace domain, and on top of the standard domain that we're used to, surface, subsurface, and land. So those are things where you really do need to have a strong national defense, so that you can protect yourself from crazy actors that can cause problems and mayhem in your country.
Yeah. Well, once again, Ptolemy Pruden, you are the author of China Rising, The Case for Containment. And your book is broken down into three parts. Once again, it's history and policy, technology and war, and the economics of war. And I'll say it again, I'd love to have you on again and talk a little bit really more about the economics of war, the cost of war. We talk some about, you know, the cost of, I'll just call them devices and things like that, but we haven't really talked about the overall impact that war has on the economy as a whole. And I'd like to talk about that and then a little bit more about the history and policy. But could you refresh our minds where people could go to listen to your podcast and to go to your website?
Sure. So the podcast is home for all of our platforms and everything. It's called Common Sense Defense Podcast. And you can get information for the book, which is called China Rising, the Case for Containment. And then also there's a YouTube channel called Common Sense Defense. And you can get that information there. And there's a link there as well to the podcast. And if you want to go directly to the book, it's called thechinarisingbook.com, thechinarisingbook.com.
Okay, thank you for that. And folks, if you're watching, you can see it right behind Ptolemy. It says Common Sense Defense right back there.
QR code there.
I really appreciate all the time that you've given us today and the information. Informative, frightening, necessary, and bottom line is we all need to be aware, I think. So once again, thank you very much.
Thank you, Chuck. I appreciate you taking the time and appreciate your program.
Thank you for listening to this very important topic, and I hope you come back for part two, which will be released very soon. Also, please remember to like, share, and comment on this podcast and all podcasts from Amazing People, Amazing Things. One last thing is I apologize for any of the weak audio. Thanks again for listening. Have a great day.